There's a question period. You don't have to stay for the question period. Although most of you are so hemmed in that there's no point trying to escape. But there's a question period. And yes. Yes. I am. The Illuminati. They asked about the Illuminati, which is the name given to a group of very, very powerful people, right, who are getting together and who are making decisions about what will happen to the world. I mean, there have been various manifestations of the Illuminati, you know, over time. You know, after World War II, there was a Trilateral Commission in which, after World War II, the United States and countries in Western Europe and Japan and some important people, government people, corporation people, some important journalists, you know, powerful people got together in the Trilateral Commission. And they said, now let's look at the world and where it is now. They did this after the Vietnam War. And they said, what do we do now? And where do we go? And what is our strategy? And so on. And so there's, as you say, the Illuminati. Who, you know, you're referring to a specific book?
Several books.
The number of books written. And all I can say is, I don't have inside information about these people, but and I don't even believe it. You know, I don't believe it's necessary for like a finite group of people to get together in a room and to plan all the terrible things that go on in the world, because these terrible things are driven by what they call market forces. It's the wonderful thing about the so-called free market that all you have to do is have a system in which profit drives policy. And if money, profit, drives policy, then there will be a natural selection of events which will move everything towards disaster, you see, really. And so, but from time to time, yes, important people do get together and they talk with one another and they try to figure out, you know, what to do and how to deal with threats. You know, I don't doubt that after Seattle, you know, there were conferences that took place. And you would think, well, what? They don't have to do this, do they? They're so powerful, and we're so, you know, small. But the fact is that powerful people worry. They worry that small movements will become big movements. I mean, that's why the FBI did all... That's why the FBI did ridiculous things going after people who had very little power, because they are paranoid, you know. Although, actually, it's not paranoia. I take that back. They are realistic. They know that small movements become big movements. They know that one person on a picket line could become 10 and 100 and 1,000 and a huge... They know that, you know. So, but I figure we can't... You know, concentrate on what they're doing and thinking. We know what, you know, what they're up to, and our job is to work for the things we believe in, food, not bombs, and women's rights, and racial equality, and the rights of gays and lesbians, and of disabled people and of children, and to work on all of these things and cause them more worry. Not spend our time penetrating, their inner circles, but creating our own enormous circles, which will then finally make their inner circle impotent.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What type of organizing or social change work gives you the most hope these days?
What kind of organizing gives me the most hope these days? Well, I think it's the kind of organizing that unites various groups around what I think may be the central issue for this next period in American history. There's a kind of organizing that took place in Seattle, in Washington, and in Prague, and which is international in scope, and which is based on an alliance among many, many different groups who have different agendas, whether it's feminism or environmentalism or, decent wage for low-paid people, health and care, and so on. What unites all of these people is the fact that none of these things are obtainable, none of the things that people need are obtainable unless we have a massive change in the way the resources of the society are distributed, and the economic system, and so any kind of organizing that is aimed at that very fundamental thing, that kind of radical thing, redistribution of wealth, tearing away more and more at the system that is based on corporate profit, and trying to build a society more and more based on human need. That kind of multi-group and international organizing, it seems to me, is the most important. Yes.
Right now, I'm studying at college to become a history teacher, and I was wondering, as a teacher, if you have any advice for someone who's going to be dealing with the institutional structure.
Advice for somebody who's going to be a history teacher?
Yes.
Advice. Advice for somebody who's going to be a history teacher. Find friends. Find allies. Because you're going into a snake pit. If you go into an institution, you're going to a university, you go into the academic world, or you go into a school system, you're going to face bureaucrats, and you're going to face narrow-minded department heads and colleagues who look askance at anybody who moves outside the parameters of the textbook, you see. You're going to face all of that. So you're going to be a minority, and so you're going to have to fight, and you shouldn't have to fight alone. That's why I say look for friends. And the friends you'll find among maybe a few colleagues, but the greatest friends you'll find is among students. And the student-faculty alliances are very, very important. And there have been times when faculty have run into great, great difficulty with administrations which decided those faculty should be gotten rid of. And when students organized, they were able to keep the faculty and the institution. So, yeah. And I guess the other thing is teach the way you want to. Don't be intimidated into teaching what they want you to teach. It's very easy to be intimidated, very easy to be a history teacher who goes to radical rallies and this and that, but who in the classroom follows, the curriculum you're given and the textbooks that you're given. You don't have to burn the textbooks that you're given, but you can supplement them with good stuff, you see. And, it's a kind of, when you're a teacher in the system, you play a kind of guerrilla warfare with the system. And the reward is the reactions of your students. and you're feeling better about yourself than if you just follow the rules. Yes. About the situation in Colombia.
When I read about it in the paper, they justify spending $1.3 billion on the drug war to fight terrorists and Marxist rebels. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about what is really underlying.
Well, you probably know the answer to that, right? Oh. Of course you do. Oh. I've said don't follow instructions and, you know, be independent and do what you want. But when somebody says, get to the microphone, you know, I quail. No. This woman has asked about the situation in Colombia, you know, the $1.456 billion the United States is giving to Colombia, mostly in military aid, presumably to fight the drug war, but indeed basically to keep the present government of Colombia in power and to fight the guerrilla movement in Colombia, which is based on the poverty of the Colombian people. So I know you know, you know, very often when people ask you questions like that, it's because they know the answers, but, right? What's that? What is
why
the real reason?
Why do we feel the need to fight a war there?
The real reason why the United States is doing what it's doing?
Yeah.
Well, I think basically the same reason why the United States has intervened again and again in other countries and given military aid to other countries. It's to prevent... we don't want another Castro in Colombia. We don't want another Sandinista government in Colombia. We don't want a revolutionary movement to succeed in Colombia, which might not become a satellite of the United States. We want to maintain American influence in Colombia, and we will support whatever regime, however repressive that regime is, and this Colombian government has been repressive, we will support any kind of repressive regime and keep it in power. Because then it will play ball with American corporations and with the American political leadership. I think that's the reason. Yes. Excuse me?
As the number one world power.
Yes. United States, yeah.
Doing good, I mean, that's how the mainstream media is portraying us as these peacekeepers.
Oh.
What is your take on that?
The question is there a positive role that the United States could play in this conflict in the Middle East? Are the media portraying the United States as the peacekeepers and right, we're the, you know, we will mediate and so on and so forth? Well, it's sort of, for the United States to mediate a conflict between the Israeli government and the Palestinians is a very odd kind of situation. I mean, we've been brought into it because we're so powerful and because we insist on being the mediator. But, of course, the United States has been allied to Israel. It hasn't been allied to the Palestinian movement. It's been allied to Israel and has been giving Israel huge amounts of military and economic aid over the years. And so to expect the United States to mediate in this successfully in this situation doesn't really make any sense. And in fact, it hasn't worked. Whatever the United States comes up with will be suspect in the Palestinian world. And the most constructive thing that the United States can do is to make to decide something that's very hard for the Israeli government to decide, because the Israeli government is beset by the extremists in Israel, you see. But the United States, not beset by those extremists, having, sure, there's a pro-Israeli lobby in the United States and so on, but it's not as serious. It can be dealt with. What the United States should be doing is taking a hard look at the situation. Now I'm talking about something utopian, because the United States is not going to do this. But you ask, what could the United States? The United States should, as I say, could say what the Israeli government cannot say. The Israelis have been occupying Palestinian territory. At the end of World War II, they took what was 100% Palestinian land, and they, they insist on taking the 20% that they won by military victory in 1967 and occupying it, or finally, after an intifada and after all so much resistance, the United States is willing to say, and Israeli willing to say, and the United States willing to go along, we'll withdraw from part of, or even most of, the occupied territories, we are not going to say that this territory belongs to the Palestinians because it's Palestinian territory. It's as if after the American Revolution, the British said, we'll get out of 11 of the colonies, but not out of 11 of the states, but we insist on maintaining troops in 2 of the 13 states. And it's a very simple matter. Very simple matter of justice that the Palestinians, having been driven out of the rest of Israel after 1948, deserve to have that territory, that 20% that was taken by force in the 1967 war, and where the vast majority of the people living there are Palestinians. They deserve to have Israel military force out of there. And that's, so the United States should be saying that and saying to Israel, if you don't do that, you're not going to get our military aid anymore. Now, Israel, that's talking very tough to Israel. That's talking very tough to Israel, But if there is any role for the United States, that's the only role I can see it playing. Yes?
Well, two things. First, just to follow up on your point. I think the solution to the problem can be difficult. I don't think it's aided on either side by stating certain polarized facts. And it certainly wasn't the case that before World War II was 100% Palestinian land. It was under the control of the mandate. There was no Palestine at that point. There were Jews and Arabs living there. There were many plans suggested, so it was kind of inaccurate to say that. But the second thing I wanted to ask,
you ask, are there any situations which would justify military intervention? No, I can't think of any situations that would justify military intervention. No, because I can think of situations that justify intervention, but not military intervention. I can think of situations that justify the sending of peacekeeping forces, the sending of forces that might, for instance, that might have, and it would have taken very little in Rwanda, perhaps, to stop the slaughter at the time. It didn't take a military intervention, but it took some sort of intervention, a very small-scale peacekeeping intervention to prevent the massacres that went on. And I think intervening is possible, and it's justified to intervene in other countries non-militarily for the purpose of preventing terrible things that are going on and of keeping the peace. But there is something inherently dangerous and wrong and immoral about military interventions. Because if you look at the history of military intervention since World War II, those military interventions always turn out to be disastrous. We never turns out that we help the people we claim we are helping by these interventions. And so, for a very simple reason, the people who engage in these military interventions, their aim is not a humanitarian one. That's why we didn't intervene in any way in Rwanda. You know, there's no problem, there's no oil there, you know, and so on. I'm opposed to military intervention. I'm opposed to war, period. And we have to decide war, military intervention, military solutions never work. They may seem to work in the short run, but in the long run, they're disastrous. Sometimes they're in the short run, they're disastrous too. It's not a matter of being isolationist in the world. It's a matter of intervening without military force in every possible way we can to help bring about just solutions to problems in the world. Yeah. Yes.
I was just curious what words of advice for change you would have for those out there in this country who are well-educated, well-off, but feeling guilty. I was curious what words of advice for change you have for those in this country who are well-educated, well-off, and feeling guilty, but tempted to let others be their vanguard.
But what?
They're tempted to let other people be their vanguard.
Oh.
Mm. Not that you should know that, but I'm just curious what you feel about that.
She's asked.
She's asking me, the people who are well off and educated and so on, what can they do? And then she says, but, you know, I don't really expect you to know the answer to that question. And you're right. I don't know the answer to that question. Well, no, I'm joking, of course. What can we do? We do what everybody else does. The fact that we may be well off and educated should not get in the way of whatever we want to do. We should join with people who are not so well off and not so well educated, but who may be more intelligent, and join with all these people in the movements for social change. That's all I can say. There's time for one more question, because 9 o'clock is the deadline. Who is the most eager? Who is? Okay. I don't know why I'm choosing you. That's why. Okay.
I have a question. What kind of convincing argument could you make to those who are enthusiastic of what Ralph Nader stands for, but are very scared of having George W. Bush as president in light of, like, potential Supreme Court vacancies?
Yes, what can I say to people who are enthusiastic for Nader, but who are fearful of George Bush, and thinking about the Supreme Court and Supreme Court appointments? And, well, it may be, you know, it may be true, and it's not certain, you know, that the appointments of the Supreme Court will be radically different, whether Bush is in or Gore is in, because ultimately the Senate has to approve these appointments. What's that?
That's right.
I didn't hear. Oh, she said amen? Is that what she said? I forgot. That's a church. That's what people say here. I see. Okay. But you know, I wouldn't claim, you know, there's absolutely no difference between Gore and Bush, although sometimes the difference is not to the advantage of Gore. I mean, it might be that on, and I don't know this, and you never know this in advance, and, you know, Bush seems more cautious about military intervention than Gore, although you never know in a situation who's, both of them are really interventionists. Both of them are for a big military budget. And I guess what I'm saying is that whatever differences, marginal, and they're marginal differences you can find. Maybe the Supreme Court, maybe not. As I said, the Supreme Court requires both Republicans and Democrats to agree before a Supreme Court justice is nominated. And, Scalia, the worst member of the Supreme Court, was unanimously voted for by every Democrat in the Senate, including Gore and Lieberman. And so, to predicate your voting for Gore on the basis of, well, it will make a big difference in the Supreme Court, I'm dubious. Say another thing about the Supreme Court. What the Supreme Court decides is not so much based on who are the members of the Supreme Court sitting on the court at this time, but in the long run based on what is happening in the country and what kind of movements do you have in the country. And if you have a great women's movement in the country, Roe v. Wade is not going to be overturned. I really believe that. And as for other differences are marginal. Both of them want to take huge chunks of the presumed surplus and pay off the bondholders, really. When that money could, both of them, except, Bush wants to pay more of it to the bondholders than Gore. But that's that's the difference, Bush asks from his financial donors who want to attend dinner with him, he asks $400,000 a head. Gore asks $300,000 a head. Those are the differences between them. On foreign policy, it's very hard to find a difference. They're both for landmines, and they're both for a huge military budget. They're both for, maintaining troops wherever we have troops. And domestic, they're both for the death penalty. They both support of the devastation Clinton did to poor families when he signed the so-called welfare reform. They're both in favor of building more prisons, as in the crime bill that was passed during the Clinton administration. And I'm not willing to surrender my conscience, to put it another way, to vote for somebody who might be a slightly lesser evil every 4 years means you will always be stuck with evil. You say, always. You see. It's not a matter of a short term who's in the White House. It's a matter of a long term. How do we build a new political movement, a new independent political movement? So, anyway, thank you.
Quick announcements. The Greens are here again. This is the last day you can register to vote. They're going to take it, all your filled out registrations to a magic post office that is open till midnight. So if you're not registered, please do it now. Also, we have people with pots going around. Please, if there's any other additional donations, please give them to us. That is very, very important. That is how we get stuff done. And again, the cops did steal all our stuff at our last fundraiser, so we are really quite desperate. The last announcement is that Freedom Rising and other activists are meeting on Sundays at 3 o'clock in spontaneous celebrations to create puppeteer theater actions to protest this uniparty system. And on November 7th, have a People's Victory Party, which you can ask me about. Thank you so much for coming, and there's food and pastries outside.